for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Governor Rick Scott recently vetoed a bill that would have effectively ended lifetime alimony in Florida. A similar measure took effect in Massachusetts last year. Comparable bills are pending in New Jersey, Connecticut, and Oregon. Joining me to talk about the purpose of alimony, how it's awarded, and whether it should be changed, Cheryl Lynn Hepfer, past president of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, and Ann Sunt, a retired circuit court judge, joining us from a studio in San Francisco, activist and author Warren Farrell. I'm sure many of you have been involved in such situations. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning, all.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Before we begin our conversation here in the studio and with you, Warren Farrell, we're joined by phone from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, by Judith McMullen. She's professor of the law at Marquette University. Good morning, Judith.
Hi, Diane.
I'd appreciate getting some basic statistics here. For example, the percentage of American marriages that end in divorce today. Give us that figure.
The figure you usually hear is 50%. That's 50% of first marriages. The rate tends to go up a bit with second and third marriages. Second marriage is somewhere in the 60s. Third marriage is somewhere in the 70s.
Wow.
And there's some difference in demographic groups. The rate of divorce has been dropping slightly among college-educated partners, for example.
And the percentage of divorcing spouses who receive alimony?
That varies a lot from state to state. It's been going down over time nationally. So, for example, in the early part of the 20th century, very early in the 20th century, maybe around 9 or 10% of divorces had permanent alimony. By around 1950, the rate was about 25% of divorces getting some alimony, but the range was huge. It was from, there's only one or two studies, it ranged from like 7% in Florida to 48% in Kansas.
I see.
Now it's much less. Now it's closer to, depending on the state you're in Wisconsin, I did a study in 2005, and it was 8% alimony, about 11% if you counted a hybrid form of alimony that we have here.
And how many states have actually ended permanent alimony?
By statute, only a handful of them. You mentioned Massachusetts. Texas has greatly limited it to hardship cases. Kansas and Utah have not abolished alimony per se, but they have put time limits on it. So permanent alimony is gone. You can go into court and ask for modifications later if some hardship comes up. But I should say that a lot of states have de facto limited alimony by simply applying it mainly in situations that include hardship, that include where people need rehabilitation, basically.
I see. And is alimony still primarily going to women?
Yes. In the study that we did in Wisconsin in 2005, there were 64 cases in our sample that got alimony. Only two of them were husbands getting alimony. There's probably, theoretically, alimony statutes are gender neutral. There's probably still some social prejudice against it. Wives probably make the claims more. And it's a changing landscape because there are more stay-at-home dads than there used to be.
Judith McMullen, she's professor of law at Marquette University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And turning to you now, Cheryl Hepfer, why the push by more states to end lifetime alimony?
Well, I think that there have been some changes in the way we function as a society over recent years. More women are joining the workforce. Although I will tell you that the 2011 U.S. Census Bureau report indicated that women earned 77 cents to every dollar a man earns. And it's very interesting that even in categories that we would think of typically as being careers for women, like nursing, actually pursuant to that same U.S. Census Bureau report, male nurses earned $60,700 per year, whereas women earned $51,100 a year. But I believe that there is significant incentive on the part of young women to secure an education. We know that more women are completing their college educations than men now. And I think young women want to be financially independent. So there is certainly a move culturally and in society for women to be more financially independent than they had been in my mother's years and in my grandmother's years. And I believe that we've also seen a significant change in the number of women staying home when their children are young. And now we see some men actually sharing in those responsibilities.
Yeah.
So I think that there have been some significant changes in our society recently.
Sherilyn Hepfer, she's past president of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. She is a family law attorney practicing in Bethesda, Maryland. Turning to you, Anne Sunt, as a retired circuit court judge, talk about the purpose of alimony and why it is that more and more women are paying alimony today.
Well, the purpose of alimony has radically changed. And it changed by a legislative fiat back in 1980 because the governor commissioned a group to study alimony. And previous to that, it really was a gender sort of thing. It was an amount being paid to women. And I think it was based on assumptions that have changed radically. The assumptions for 200 years from the 1700s were that women didn't work and that they were entitled. They had a right to be supported by their spouses. And as Cheryl commented, all of that has changed. I think I was probably part of the last generation of women who had choices. We liked the idea of a career, but it wasn't required of us. There was still that idea that you would be taken care of by your spouse. So those assumptions now have changed. And the new alimony statute, which is now about 35 years old, really says right up front, we expect people to be self-supporting. And the purpose of alimony really is to enable people to be more self-supporting. And we'll give you a limited amount of time, if you need training, if you need education, hence that really pejorative word, rehabilitative alimony, like you need to be cured or straightened out. But the concept is we'll help you make that transition from a family, two people working together, to two single separate lives. But we expect you to be self-supporting.
And since she's a retired circuit court judge, turning to you, Warren Farrell, do you believe that an alimony award should have a fixed termination date?
Yeah, I think that it's probably helpful to have a guideline of about 10 to 15 years. I do think there is a purpose to alimony. I don't think permanent alimony is really a useful concept, and it usually tends to engender entitlement. But I think that we're going to be seeing, and just to give a little bit of clarifying comments to a few things that have been said, nationwide it's 4% of the of alimony goes to men, 3.6% in more precise terms. And but women earn about 20% of the time, women who earn more than their husbands do in marriages, and 38% of the time when both sexes work, the women earn more. But alimony is still a fairly gendered thing. And the reform in alimony will really be the reform of second wives fighting with first wives, or women who are earning more than men. Men have, for a long period of time, accepted alimony as sort of part of the cost of love, a little bit like diamonds and drinks and dinners and dates and flowers and Valentine's Day. They're all sort of the cost of love that men have learned.
Right,
is part of the process. But so men are not fighting that nearly as strongly as second wives will be fighting that, and that women earning more than men will be fighting that. And so that's, I think, the part of that transition. On the issue of the genders earning a dollar versus 76 cents, this is one of the most destructive to women statistics and most erroneous pieces of information that we believe.
All
for
right.
example, in the nurse's case.
Warren,
oh, go ahead.
We've got
Sorry.
To take a short break here.
Sure.
So we'll talk more about your views on that disparity in earning when we come back. And, of course, in this hour, we are talking about alimony. There are some states which have declared that the idea of permanent alimony will no longer be part of divorce settlements. Warren Farrell is on the line with us. And, Warren, just before the break, you were talking about the skewed, I gather, statistics as you see them in regard to women's earnings versus men's earnings.
Yes, when you look at the not just the category like nurse or doctor, you will find that men, male doctors and male nurses both earn more than female doctors and female nurses. When you look more closely at the category, you find that the subspecializations that men and women earn, work in, tend to lead, for example, men are far more likely as doctors to be cardiologists. Women are far more likely to be general practitioners. Male nurses are more likely to be nurse anesthesiologists. As a rule, nurse anesthesiologists earn over $100,000 a year. And so what's really helpful to our daughters is to teach them which specialties earn more and which specialties earn less if we want them to earn more. But when we control for the specialties, the number of years worked, the number of hours worked per week, the willingness to go to places that people don't want to go to, locations that they don't want to move to, which pay more. When you control for variables like hazardous work and so on, and you put the 25 major variables together, only about 7 or 8 of which are normally controlled for, then you have women and men earning about equal, maybe women earning a little bit more for the same work, same time, et cetera.
Then get back to the issue of a fixed termination date for alimony.
I think 10 to 15 years is really a very valid time. I think alimony does have a useful purpose, and we shouldn't go from one extreme to the other. When a woman or a man takes off to be full-time involved with the children, he or she does lose many years that are useful in the workplace. And when my father, for example, was he left a job because my mom wanted him to leave a job because she was depressed in Europe, came back, left a job as a manager of a major company, came back and sold Fuller brushes. Now, he wouldn't have applied for alimony, but it's an example of when he was 50 years of age, it was difficult for him, as it would be for a woman, to find a job when you've been, even when he was productively in a managerial position for a long period of time.
All right. Warren Farrell, he's an activist and author of several books, including Why Men Earn More and What Women Can Do About It. And, son, I recognize that awards differ from state to state. But how do you, as a judge, approach these various cases when perhaps a woman has not been working, her husband or she wants the divorce, but the woman clearly has no income yet? How do you deal with that?
May I just very quickly say that whatever I say here, I'm speaking only for myself.
Absolutely.
Because clearly, if you had 5 judges sitting in this room, you would get 5 different opinions.
Fine.
So my experience, both as a lawyer and as a judge, and then recently as a mediator, has made me very allergic to alimony. I worry about alimony. When Warren says 10 to 15 years, I picture a cliff. What happens at the end of 10 or 15 years? She just falls off the edge, or he falls off the edge if he's the recipient. So I'm always looking for a more long-term solution. And if you have parties who have means, then you have really all kinds of options available to you as a judge or even as a mediator to suggest that maybe one spouse should take 90% of the assets, put them in a bank, get a financial advisor, and look to see if the assets can generate sufficient income. Because the difficulty with alimony is not just that it's such a variable and not just that 5 different judges will make 5 different decisions, but it's also an ongoing binding of parties who are generally trying to separate their lives.
So what you're saying is rather than assessing a particular rate or a particular length for alimony, you're saying look at the assets, look at what one person is capable of having earned during the time of that marriage, and then award the person who has not earned the money but perhaps has stayed behind to raise the children, keep the home, and so on, while the other individual who has earned that money is going to likely go on
continue
to earn even more money. So you're saying separate the two, but give one 90% of the asset. Cheryl, how does that sound to you?
Well, first of all, the significant majority of cases are resolved by agreement without ever getting into the court system.
I'm glad to hear that.
And they are solved with creative, thoughtful assessment and generally by people trying to be fair to each other. Courts tend to be required to do equity, certainly family law courts. Equity is fairness, and what's fair can be significantly different one case to the next, which is why general rules and following very firm guidelines don't work in those few cases that require court involvement. They are normally the extreme cases. They are normally the cases that have the greatest degree of hostility and bitterness. They are often the cases that have unique circumstances that require some additional evaluation. The parties are unable to proceed on their own, and the court then tends to try to come up with a fair and equitable resolution. And sometimes they do a good job of that. Sometimes they don't. That's why we have appellate courts. But the reality is that there are benefits to using alimony. Alimony is deductible to the payor. The person receiving alimony pays taxes on that. And when there's significant disparity between the tax rate of the person who's earning the significant income and the person who will receive alimony, creative measures between attorneys, financial planners, and accountants can actually keep more money in the family by using that very appropriate process of paying alimony.
So what are your specific concerns about ending permanent alimony as an option?
Well, my concern is that it's not going to solve the problem. Currently, almost every situation involving alimony is modifiable, so that if the payor becomes ill or retires, has an accident, something significant occurs that hadn't been contemplated, the parties generally on their own come to an agreement to modify. And in those few cases that go to court, the court has the ability to modify based upon what's fair. To have an absolute cutoff date when one party is predicted to be prepared to be able to meet their own needs because the court assumes or the law assumes that after a period of 10 years, let's say, they're going to be just fine. The reality is that in many cases, 10 years is just not appropriate to terminate all alimony. So having the ability to predict the future is not something that most judges are capable of doing, and certainly we lawyers aren't capable of doing that, which is why modification and the ability for people to sit down and try to resolve situations where there have been changes or the court of necessity seems to me to be much better than having an absolute cutoff after a period of time.
Let me turn to you, Anne. Were there any circumstances under which you did award permanent alimony?
Absolutely.
Can you give me an outline?
Sure. The statute really does provide for that. We really have a fairly kind statute because although it sets out this aspiration of a limited alimony, it does provide that even if somebody who has made best efforts to become self-supporting isn't, or even if they're self-supporting, I'm not sure what that means. For instance, in an affluent county, what that means to be self-supporting. But if the disparity in income between the recipient and the payor is what they call shocking, shocks the conscience. And I've had cases like that. Somebody at best could earn $30,000 and the other spouse is earning over $1 million. That's going to be an indefinite alimony case.
What do you think about that, Warren?
I really agree with a lot of what Judge Sunt is saying, and that is that you really that assets, for example, are a better way to go because many times second wives or second husbands, especially second wives, feel really they feel when a check is being paid out to the ex, it seems to have an emotional impact that's very negative on the second wife, and so that's if there's enough assets to divide, that's probably a good way to go in terms of having the psychological damage or remnants of the first marriage a little bit more free for a parent. I think there is a value to having both the aspiration be limited and also the amount of time being limited under almost every circumstance, and the law can never be. People are much more complex than a law is, and so I think the need for flexibility is really important. But I think that if a person knows I'm going to have 10,000 coming to me this year, 8,000 the next, 6,000 the next, and so on, they can plan accordingly and adjust accordingly.
But on the other hand, what about concerns regarding, say, disabled or older wives or a husband, Cheryl?
Well, that's a significant concern, and that's why having very significant rules that don't provide with the ability for the courts to consider those extraordinary circumstances is really inequitable and unfair.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want to read for you a portion of an email from Jay, who lives in Massachusetts. He says, I was ordered by the court to pay my ex-spouse 180% of my unemployment benefits while I am unemployed. I'm at the end of my career, having a very difficult time finding a job after my position was eliminated. My ex does not have to touch the 50% of assets received in the divorce settlement. It's just plain crazy that the amount of alimony paid is set when you are working at the peak of your career and you get no relief when you're having difficulty. And Anson, I gather you'd agree with that.
Well, the one thing I certainly did learn sitting on the bench is that there are always two sides.
Of course.
And this sounds just awful. It's one of the reasons why I always look for an alternative to alimony. I'm trying so hard to help these people do what they say they want to do, which is to untie themselves. And I think alimony keeps them bound on a roller coaster. Whether it's good fortune or bad, usually somebody doesn't share in the good fortune of the payor, but they certainly do share in the misery. So the difficulty, of course, is if there are not other assets to be divided, then what?
And joining us now by phone from Melbourne, Florida, is Alan Frischer. He's president of Florida Alimony Reform. Good morning to you, Alan. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Describe the alimony reform that you pushed for.
Well, what we tried to do, and because I'm basically down in the trenches, I was listening to what everybody was saying, and certainly academically and legally there are words written on paper, but what is practically happening in the courts are a whole nother thing entirely. The arbitrary and unbridled discretion of many judges, in this case, ruling on these cases, give them the ability not to be consistent, not to have any predictability. And like the judge said, five different judges can have five different opinions. More importantly, the same judge can have different opinions when basically the same factual situation occurs in cases. So what we tried to do with the reform movement in Florida is allow for certain guidelines to be put in place to allow for predictability and consistency throughout the state.
But I gather that your goal is to eliminate most alimony.
No, well, that's not the case. We actually believe that a certain amount of rehabilitative alimony is quite necessary in most cases. What we've tried to do is eliminate the permanency of it. We don't believe anything should be permanent in the law. And while modifications can occur, we found practically that's very rare. Most judges do not allow for modifications when they do go before the judge to ask for them, because there's no definition of what a significant change of circumstance would be.
So Governor Scott did just veto that permanent alimony bill. I gather he had concerns about applying the law retroactively.
Yes, he did. I was recently at a dinner with Governor Scott, and I had the opportunity to speak with him personally about this. And he said while he is for reform, he believes that the retroactive part of it would have been very challenging and very difficult. So he wants me to come back and present something different to him that may be able to allow for a certain amount of retroactivity.
All right, Alan Frischer, President of Florida Alimony Reform. Thanks so much for joining us. And short break here. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
The rescue of an American aid worker kidnapped in Somalia, the story of her ordeal, and why she intends to return to Africa. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. Time to open the phones. Let's go first to Sherry in Ocala, Florida. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you, and thank you for having me on your show.
You're most welcome.
Thank you to your guests. I called the governor, and I followed the Florida alimony reform that was in place. I had asked the governor to veto it. And my son, who is a disabled young adult, also asked the governor to veto it. Right now, I've been in a long-term marriage, many children, over 20 years of marriage. I also have a disability. With my disability, there was a settlement, which those funds, part of them were used toward promoting my husband further in his career. And, you know, with the alimony reform, the way it was written, I didn't feel that it gave equal protection under the law. Yes, I was a stay-at-home mom for many years. In fact, in the mediation for this settlement, when they calculated what I did within my household, I actually, the value of service was double to what my husband earned at that time.
You know, someday our work in the home is going to be calculated. Cheryl.
Well, I often ask people whether or not their spouse works outside the home, because certainly they do work inside the home, we all know. But I agree with your statements very much, which is why I, too, believe having limitations on alimony is a significant concern to people. Those who make the choice, normally it's a joint choice to have one parent stay home with children for a significant period of time, don't realize at the time, or do realize and are willing to accept the consequence of that, that the ability to further their career, even if they do become, quote, rehabilitated, as Judge Sun says, whatever that might mean, simply do not have the capability to earn the same type of income that of those who continue on in their career through the young children stages of marriage, and it cannot be replicated. You can't make it up. So unless and until there is some value placed on that by society or by maximizing earnings later, and unless and until there's some way of dealing with people who, like you, have children who are special needs and as a result have limitations and their ability to work outside the home, having a consequence that is absolute, you know, 10 years or 15 years, no matter what, I think is arbitrary and capricious and will result in consequences that will be staggering for our society.
All right, here's an email for Warren Farrell. What are your thoughts on how long alimony should be if one of the individuals in the divorced relationship is permanently disabled and collects SSDI?
Yeah, I think that in cases like that, there should be flexibility to, you know, permanence of alimony shouldn't be like knocked out of the law, but it should certainly be an aspiration for all of us to avoid whenever we can. You know, long-term dependency really does create a bad psychology. I think something that I would like to address here is, you know, what we all really want is to prevent the whole divorce from occurring to begin with. And then I think we also have an interest and I think the way to deal with that is in school we teach algebra, trigonometry, calculus, but we don't teach communication. And the part of communication that we don't teach at all is how to handle personal criticism from a loved one without becoming defensive. And that's a skill set that almost the Achilles heel of human beings is our inability to handle personal criticism, particularly from loved ones. Yes, go ahead.
A whole program of its own, which at some point I do hope we can take up. Here's an email from Peter who says, when military people get divorced, their spouses get ownership of part of the service member's retirement. This isn't alimony that can be set or adjusted by the court. It's permanent ownership as though it were a tangible piece of property. Is this changing, Cheryl?
Well, I don't think it's going to change. Actually, the states determined early on that there should be some fair distribution of marital property, either community property division, which is almost always 50-50, or equitable distribution, which could be something other than 50-50. This issue was actually addressed by the United States Supreme Court, and the court determined that military retirement is an asset to be divided upon divorce, just like any other retirement would be. And generally, it's divided on a formula of if, as, and when for a portion of the military service during the marriage.
I see. A few emailers are asking Ann Sunt to explain the difference between alimony and child support. And what about prenuptial agreements?
Oh, my gosh. Where do I begin? I'm in favor of prenuptial agreements.
You are.
I am. You know, even if the agreements are never upheld, even if they're ripped up and thrown away, it means at least that youngsters entering into this relationship have given it some thought. And I think that's a very wise thing to do, particularly with more and more households where there are both parents working.
Indeed.
But child support is a whole different factor. I mean, alimony impacts child support, and that's another piece of this, because we have child support guidelines, and into those guidelines go the incomes of both parties, and if one is paying the other one some alimony, that changes the whole child support scheme. The interesting parallel is one that I think you or Cheryl mentioned earlier. We have an automatic cutoff of child support, and all of us know, either within our own households or we have friends whose adult children are not self-supporting.
Beyond the age of 18? Really?
19, yeah. If they're in high school?
Absolutely.
So we don't just throw them out on the street. We continue, but there's no legislative requirement that we do that. So go ahead.
Let's go to Montgomery, New Jersey. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning. Thank you so much for addressing this important issue on your show. My question would be for the past president of the AAML. My question to you is, I'd like you to reconcile what you're saying here today with the AAML 2007 report, which recommended durational guidelines for alimony because of the fact that there is no predictability with unlimited discretion with judges and no guidelines at all.
Cheryl.
I'm glad you brought that up, Stuart, because it was on my checklist for me to be sure to mention here today. The American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, years ago, as you say, in 2007, I believe, came up with guidelines in great part because we were concerned about the significant disparity in lifestyles that were afforded when women were not afforded a reasonable amount of support. Again, we today are not limiting this to women. I know that we started out with some statistics that indicated that there are few men who receive support alimony. It's mostly women who are receiving it. But I assure you that 10 years from now, that statistic will be changed, especially as a result of same-sex marriages. And the fact that same-sex couples are raising children together, and one of them, sometimes both, will spend considerable time rearing their children. But when we came up with the guidelines, they were meant to be guidelines. They were not affected by any state that I'm aware of in the union adopting them. In fact, in Maryland, they are to be considered by the court as just one of many factors to give guidance. That was the purpose of them. That's what they were meant to be. And because the guidelines, of course, were meant to be considered by all 50 states, and because income can be significantly variable in some states vis-a-vis others, it's a lot more expensive to live, for example, in the Manhattan area than it might be, for example, in Arkansas. It was never intended that those guidelines were going to be just adopted.
All right. Here's an email from Bonnie, who says there is too much abuse in alimony and modifications are too rare. And the addition of effectively forcing a new spouse to pay for someone's previous spouse is unconscionable, as that person may still be reeling from a previous divorce themselves. Alimony is properly and too rarely used as a lifeline to the future. Ann Sund.
I'm not sure which part of this I agree with, but a good deal of it because, as I started out by saying, I try very hard to look for some other alternative. I see alimony the same way I see the court. It's a last resort. Most people do resolve their differences, and they work it out, and then they take responsibility and ownership for their own contracts. The people who come to court, for whatever reason, can't do that or won't do it, and so a third party does it for them. Alimony is a little bit like that. If there's some other way to untangle the relationship, to make sure that everybody is fairly treated, the parties will find that, given suggestions, opportunities. And it's only when they can't do that that a third party has to make a decision.
All right, let's go to Barrington, Rhode Island. Let's hear from David. Good morning to you.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Sure.
It's a really complicated and complex topic, but one of the guests, and she just mentioned that most seem to get settled before they get to court. In my experience, based on all the friends that I know that have gone through this very difficult process, is that they usually do all end up in court. And you take something that is sort of an emotional contract and you kind of fit it into this legalistic contract, and it seems to perpetuate this this adversarial process. And I'm just wondering how they see the courts kind of bringing a little more compassion or something into the system so that it seems to be a fair process even when they do get to court, because my experience is that most end up in court. And I don't know where the guest recites the information or the data that says that most settle before they get to court.
David, may I ask you a question?
Sure.
Did you turn to a mediator before you got to court?
We did try to do that, and we were moving along in that process. But I found that once we got into the legal system, that in some ways the legal system almost perpetuated the animosity that kind of grew out of it. And I'm wondering if that's true. If you have children, if it becomes more adverse because children add a whole other dynamic to it.
Indeed.
Let me add something here, if I may.
All right, hold on 1 second. Just to remind listeners that you are listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Warren, go right ahead.
I deal with courts a lot, and one of the things that I often think is that there needs to be a form of couples communication or mediation that is not where the mediator or that couples communicator person does not need to report what is being said in the sessions into court that precedes the one where something is reported to court. I think what I see with many couples is that they're afraid to say something that is constructive, that is loving, that is appreciative, that is acknowledging to the other person, or to sort of bend a little bit for fear that it will be used against them in court. And I wanted to ask Judge Sunt if she agreed or saw the possibility for that being incorporated into the system.
Absolutely. And we don't ask mediators to report in the court. I think to respond both to you and the previous caller, most court systems now do try to build in mediation services. But, you know, somebody has to file in order to get a divorce.
Sure.
And that has a wicked effect because it starts a timeline running. And some courts are very efficient. If you file, then by golly, you are going to get divorced within a year or 9 months or whatever their timeline standard is.
So
I think more and more couples now are learning, and they're getting good coaching, counseling from their attorneys. Hold off on the filing. Try the mediation process so that you don't find yourself in an adversarial position
the
get-go.
Such a good point.
Yes.
And finally, here's an email from Stephanie, who says she's thinking ahead as a stay-at-home mom. What would you recommend I do to protect myself financially now in the event of a divorce later? Cheryl.
And I think that my mention previously about prenups and postnups is a point well taken. We are finding that more and more people are entering into prenups. It used to be that only the very wealthy did. We are seeing more and more postnups as a result of situations that people just encounter in their lives. One spouse says to the other, I would like to take off 3 years and work on my master's degree or do a residency after law school that will require you to work harder and basically carry me so that we together will have a better life after I'm finished with my schooling.
And how many people did we hear from in my generation who helped husbands go through medical schools and then their husbands left to marry someone else? So I think you're right on, Cheryl, with the idea of the postnup as well as the prenup, and that's got to be, sadly, the last word. I hope Stephanie takes that into account. Warren Farrell and son Cheryl Lynn Hepfer, thank you all so much.
Diane, it's a pleasure being with
you
again.
My pleasure, Diane.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Diane Rain.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and